Now on Radio 4 FM, we begin a new book of the week. Jamie Parker reads from Epilogue, a memoir. American author Will Boast's moving account of loss and coming to terms with the past. At the age of 24, the author is overwhelmed by grief.
My father was never one to complain. Growing up, I thought he was unbreakable. My younger brother Rory and I wrestled with him on the grape juice-stained shag carpet of the living room, flailing and kicking and pulling his hair. In the kitchen, he picked up trembling hot saucepans by their bare handles. When I tried, my hand shot back. On the coldest Wisconsin winter days, he went out gloveless and hatless, his face and fingers gone angry red in the frigid, prickling wind. Never bothered him. Freeze him, burn him, cut him, kiss him. He wouldn't even flinch. My father's father, Alfred J. Boast, captain in the Welsh Guards, set an impossible bar for discipline and hardiness. As a young man, he worked long, dangerous, suffocating days in the coal mines of southern Wales. As soon as World War II broke out, he joined up, and in the last years of the war, he commanded a POW camp in occupied Italy. Back home, he played rugby for both the Army and Wales. I barely remember the man, but in photos, I see all I need to know. On his wedding day, black Busby hat in one arm, bride in the other, he stands bolt upright in his dress uniform, still tanned from the Italian sun, looking like a statue chipped from one massive block of shale. This was the man who taught my dad how to throw a punch and how to take one, how to lower a shoulder on the rugby pitch and lay the other man flat. The old wisdom tells us the longer we suffer, physically and otherwise, the more indifferent we become to pain. Actually, the opposite may be true. During a long ordeal or a long depression, we begin to feel pain more acutely. We only learn to show it less. The Stoics' creed, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, keep calm and carry on, it all turns out to be nonsense. Only years later do I see that my father's upbringing and my own, Midwestern and English, left us uniquely, pathetically unequipped for the course my family's life in America would take. At the end of my senior year of high school, my mother started having bad headaches. She and I were on a road trip together, scouting colleges, when the first big one hit. We cut the trip short, and I drove us from Iowa City back to Wisconsin while she lay curled in the back seat, her eyes squeezed tightly shut. The diagnosis came that evening, a tumor in her brain. Glioblastoma, terminal cancer. 7 months later, 2 days before Christmas, she died. In the same awful week, my father's own mother also died of old age. These two deaths hardly seemed to affect him. He kept calm, steady, and mostly sober, organizing two sets of funeral arrangements with the same frightening rigor he brought to his work at the plant. I followed his example. I felt I should cry, but I couldn't. I came up with a list of chores and went at them every day until I was too exhausted to do anything but crawl into bed. When I went back to college, I bore down, filling my schedule with courses, writing arts reviews and fluff pieces for the student newspaper, playing in 5 different bands, laboring to do anything but grieve. My father could never seem to compel my younger brother toward the application of discipline and tireless work as an antidote for grief. No doubt because Dad, as a young man, had run just as wild as Rory did. Just how wild and how reckless my dad was at that age, I wouldn't find out until later. After our mother's death, Rory started partying harder than ever. He ditched school, quit doing homework, tripped on shrooms and acid at fish concerts. And my father, who downed 7 or 8 whiskeys a night, tried to cajole, lecture, and bully him out of it. The following winter, every fear my dad ever had came true. Rory was killed in a car accident, driving with his buddies, slamming beers and smoking joints, on their way to a party in the Chicago suburbs. My father, with no other means of understanding or coping with the pain of Rory's death, turned to the only medicine he knew. Broken by grief, he set to the business of drinking himself to death. After college, I moved down to Chicago, and then 2 years later, fled away to go to grad school. I told myself he wasn't hurt, that I drove home only once every couple of months, and always arrived hours later than I'd promised. I'd find him in his easy chair, holding vigil, staring out the window down the length of the driveway, drink in hand, his eyes as dull and watery as the ice-thinned whiskey. In this state, he would sometimes talk about Mom and Rory, halting, apologetic, fumbling for words. He didn't speak this language of regret, guilt, and loss. "You and me," he said, "we've got to stick together. We've got to keep the family going." He cried in front of me, and I felt ashamed for him. On the morning of the day he died, he rang me. He seemed to be in a cheerful mood.
"Rise and shine, guy," he said.
Over the years, his accent had faded, but his voice still had a musicality, a gruff sing-song. He asked if I'd taken my car in for a tune-up like he'd told me to last week. I lied and said I had. Was I doing okay on cash? Yeah, fine. We had the same conversation 2 or 3 times a week. Sometimes we talked about music, Bill Evans, modern jazz quartet, Van Morrison, but mostly practical stuff. Car, money, news from across the pond.
"Have you rung your grandmother?" he said.
"I'll call her this weekend."
"Guy, tell me you'll ring your grandmother."
"Okay, I'll call her," I said. "Anything else?"
"They say it's going to snow."
"Yeah, that's what they say."
"Drive careful, please."
"Dad, you don't have to say please. I'll be careful. I'll be fine." That evening, my father had pulled to the side of County Road B, halfway between work and home. An ulcer that he'd suffered with for years had ruptured. He was bleeding internally and, in no doubt, enormous pain, but he stopped the car on the gravel shoulder, parked neatly, turned off the engine. The Wisconsin winter stretched out on both sides of him, the endless flat fields stubbled with chewed-up stalks of corn. He had a car phone. All these years later, I'm still struggling to understand why he didn't just call for help. My parents met in Dreamland. So went the joke in our family. Dreamland was a light industrial concern on Southampton Water manufacturing electric blankets. Mom worked in personnel, Dad was a foreman on the line, and the dreamiest thing about him, in my mother's eyes anyway, was that he always forgot to take off his hairnet when he came into the office to chat her up. Soon he was taking her for drinks in town or to the Concord Club to see the giants of British jazz, Ken Collier, George Shearing, Acker Bilk. She never cared for the music, but liked seeing my dad dressed up in his camel hair coat and Yves Saint Laurent shirts. With only a few night school certificates to his name, my father had become a prodigious inventor, and his greatest triumph, the gas release valve on colostomy bags, was just starting to get him some attention. He was headhunted by a plastics company who asked him to help them open a new plant in Ireland, in a backwater town in County Limerick, touted as one of the fastest growing in Europe. We'd been in Ireland 4 years when the company decided it required Dad's skills at international headquarters. Dad flew over and went house hunting. He found a home for us in Fontana, just over the state line in Wisconsin. Dad described this small resort town to Rory and me over the phone. The clear blue lake, the sandy beaches, white sailboats dotting the water, the huge stone mansions tucked away in the trees. We were escaping the drab, rainy confines of the British Isles and lighting out for the vast plenty of America. We arrived in winter. Snowsuits, heavy coats, woolly hats, earmuffs, insulated gloves, ski masks, moon boots, chapstick, ice scrapers, antifreeze, snow shovels, snow tires. It wasn't just the numbing depth of the cold that came as a shock, but the sheer amount of stuff needed to survive in this new place. Rory and I were curiosities at Fontana Elementary. At the end of our first day, I called out, "Cheerio," to my classmates. A month later, it was still the first grade's pet joke to shout out at any provocation, "Cheerio, everyone! Cheerio!" Mom wrote to Nanny, saying she didn't know where she was sometimes. One day she was Mummy, then Mammy, and now suddenly she was Mom. When she couldn't find the words to write another letter, she'd work on her stamp collection, carefully steaming profiles of the Queen or portraits of Lord Mountbatten off powder blue Royal Air envelopes and patiently fixing them in her album. By mid-afternoon, she'd find herself staring out the window, sipping her umpteenth cup of tea, waiting for the big yellow bus to grind its way by and deposit Rory and me across the street. But the first thing we wanted to do when we got home was rush back outside. We'd wade waist-deep into a blizzard just to pelt each other with little puffs of snowballs. A couple of hours later, Dad would arrive home.
"All right, you lot," he would call out. "Who's ready for grub?"
Yawning and shaking out his shoulders, he'd change out of his work clothes and start dinner. He had a flair for cooking offal. Kidneys, oxtails, pig's knuckles. And his egg curries were a miracle of economy. There was a show on TV, The Frugal Gourmet, that he watched devoutly, but I'm not sure it's possible to make a meal for four cheaper than egg curry. Before she put Rory and me to bed, Mom would go out on the back step for a last cigarette. The winter nights were so still and silent. No leaves to rattle on the trees, no traffic. When the wind came up, she didn't hear its progress, only felt the prickling of her cheeks. In Ireland, going home was easy and cheap. Flights from Chicago to Heathrow were a different matter. 4,000 miles. Dad taught me that the worst, the weakest, the most shameful thing you could do was indulge your pain. Swallow it down. Don't say a word. You didn't talk about it. You certainly didn't write about it. His methods killed him. But he did with his pain only what he'd been taught to do. All he knew how to do. Now the question remains, what will I do with mine?
Jamie Parker was reading Epilogue, a memoir by Will Boast. The book was abridged by Miranda Emerson and produced by Gemma Jenkins. Why do we eat in secret, and when does it count as an eating disorder? It's on Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes after the news. But first, Alan Urey looks ahead to Filong 4.
The government says docking welfare payments under a regime of sanctions helps people to get a job and is bringing down unemployment. But what evidence is there to support that? A leading academic tells us the system is a shambles. There's mounting concern these penalties are punishing the vulnerable. We've had exclusive access to new research showing thousands of people with mental health problems are having their payments stopped even when they've been officially declared too ill to work. Are the rules and penalties unfair to those who are least able to cope? That's File on 4, tomorrow night at 8.